So the first thing we have to decide off the bat is, are we going to say Trigon Empire or Trigon Empire?
Right. Let's just get this clear,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What does Oliver think? Oliver, you think...
I have always said Trigon.
Trigon.
But I am from the north of England.
Yeah, it's different up there.
Yeah.
I've heard. North
they
of the
do,
wall.
They do things differently there.
Yeah, very cold.
Yeah, I believe it is Trigon, but right. I naturally say Trigon. So yeah. If I say Trigon during this conversation, feel free to correct, in your own mind, not out loud, feel free to correct me quietly and think Trigon.
So think quietly. Yeah. And just whisper to yourself.
Trigon, yeah. Trigon, Trigon. Because that was a diktat we had, wasn't it? Trigon. No, Trigon. Trigon? Trigon. Trigon. Trigon.
Definitely not Trigon.
Trugan. Trugan A.
Isn't that a garden in Wales?
Oh, it could be, yeah. So hang on. So
if you say Trigon, try again, because it's Trigon.
Lovely. I think the easiest thing to do is just always ask you what you say, because that's definitely wrong.
Okay.
So we know that.
What I think we should do is alternate between the two things constantly during the course of this chat just, you know, let people make their own minds up.
There's very little chance I won't do that anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Trigon, Trigon, Trugan.
Trigon.
Trigon. Trigon. Trigon.
Good, this has gone well, I think.
Yeah. We're off to a flying start.
This is like Slain all over again.
You mean Schlane?
Yeah. Coming to you direct from the nerve centre of the galaxy's greatest comic, this is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borok Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I'm your host, Mulchar, and this week I am joined by graphic novel editor Oliver Pickles.
Hello.
And deputy publishing manager Rob Power.
Hello, everybody.
And we're going to be talking about a couple of the non-2000 AD things that we've got coming up, announcements that we've just made, just because they're very different to the kind of things we do with 2000 AD, but slightly feed into it. And I think, you know, it's news that is worth celebrating. The first is that for the first ever time, Roy of the Rovers is going to feature a lead female character in the shape of Rocky Race, Roy's younger sister. And we're going to be talking to Oliver about the release of the Trigon Empire by Mike Butterworth and Don Lawrence next year. I reserve the right to just change how I pronounce that throughout. Let's start off talking about Roy the Rovers, because actually this is quite a major announcement, isn't it, Rob? Tell us a little bit about what we've done.
Yeah. So, well, the announcement is that we're putting out a free story alongside the Women's World Cup, starring Rocky Race, which is Roy's little sister, who has appeared in the graphic novels and the fiction that we've put out as part of the Roy the Rovers reboot, which is all very, very exciting. And I think it's the first time that a female character has led a Roy the Rovers story in 65 years worth of Roy stuff going on. We're working alongside the National Literacy Trust and the FA and the Lionesses, as the England ladies team is called. Ladies team? Yeah, it is ladies' team, isn't it? It's the Women's World Cup. Is it the women's team or the ladies' team? I don't know. Not sure. Either way, they're great. We love them.
Yeah.
The whole point is that we wanted, right from the beginning with Roy the Rovers, we wanted it to be properly inclusive. So there's been girls playing football, boys playing football, a diverse team, where Roy's entire family sits at the heart of all the stories. So it's not just about Roy, it's about Roy, it's about his sister, it's about his dad who's disabled, and it's about his mum who holds down two jobs while trying to keep the family together and keep them going. So that's always sat at the heart of the reboot. And we knew as soon as Tom Palmer, who writes the fiction, as soon as he turned in the first book, we knew that Rocky was going to be a standout character, because she's so sparky and full of life, and he writes her so brilliantly. She's also arguably better at football than Roy, which is may prove tricky in the future, but she's, you know, she's a great character, and Tom has been really keen to do more with her. So as we've gone on, we're just about to put out our sixth book in total. So we've had three graphic novels, three fiction titles. Rocky's probably featured more in the fiction than in the graphic novels, so it made sense that when the National Literacy Trust came to us and said we want to do something for the Women's World Cup, Rocky was the perfect character to use for that, because they wanted to do something with Tom anyway. He's done various live stories with them before. So it just kind of all fit and made sense. So so we've been working with Tom on developing the story. It will follow along with the tournament, which is taking place in France across June, and I think it goes into July. And essentially what happens is Tom writes a chunk of story alongside every England game. So, and then kids in classrooms can follow along, kids at home can follow along with their parents, anyone can follow along and download it. It's all free, it's all available from the National Literacy Trust website, and we'll link to it from our social media, etc. And it's, you know, it's a really big deal, and I think we were talking about this yesterday. It's amazing how far and wide Roy de Rovers goes, really. Everybody's heard of Roy de Rovers, whether you like football or not. You've heard of Roy de Rovers. He's a genuine household name, and as we saw with the announcement of this project, front page of the Times, Sky News covered it, was in some other papers that we won't mention here because we don't like them very much, but still great to get national media coverage. I believe Tom's on Talk Sport today. You know, there's all sorts going on around it, and it's just one small part of a much bigger project. So it's very exciting.
So with the Roy the Rover stuff, so much of it has been happening outside of the comics bubble because we've not been necessarily targeting the same readership that, that we target with some of our other stuff, particularly not the Treasury of British Comics reprints, which, although, you know, most of it is all ages, it still tends to be the older audience who remember reading it the first time. This is very specifically targeted at kids. Tell us a little bit about the when we were planning what to do with Roy the Rovers once we owned him as part of the archive. Why we decided that was the way forward? Because I saw so many dismissive comments online. As you would expect.
They've dried up now, funnily enough.
That isn't it. You know, oh, is he going to have loads of tattoos? Is he going to be on $500,000 a week? That kind of rubbish. But throughout, we've kind of maintain that decision to aim it at kids.
We had a very clear idea what we wanted to do with the reboot pretty early on. I think we did have the discussion, you know, should we pick up where the comics left off? I think they finished in sort of the turn of the century, really, around 2001. I think and we just felt that because he'd been off the newsstands for so long, you know, there's a whole generation of kids that don't know who Roy de Rovers is. So we thought, okay, clean break, let's start again. 16-year-old Roy, and we knew that we wanted to do something that was true to the core of the character, because I think, you know, in comics, you know, characters are rebooted all the time, and the thing that allows you to do that is when you keep true to those core characteristics. You know, that's how you can have so many versions of Superman or iterations of Spider-Man or whoever. And Roy de Rovers does sit in that. He sits in that world. He's got the same. You know, everybody knows what Roy de Rovers is all about. It's about fair play, it's about great goals, it's about teamwork, it's about all that good stuff that you want in a great sportsman. You know, he's a Bobby Moore, he's a Gary Lineker, you know. And he's a great British footballing character. So we wanted to try and embody all of those virtues while bringing him up to date. Not the easiest thing, given that, as we saw in a lot of the comments, you know, the public perception of footballers isn't exactly at an all-time high, you know. People are very quick to dismiss footballers. People are very quick to jump on them for, you know, their wages, their poor performance, some of the PR disasters that footballers have had over the last 10-20 years even. You know, there's been a lot of negative press around some footballers and some of the antics they've got up to, and that sort of thing is very visible. People love to, you know, talk about and read about that kind of scurrilous stuff that you get in the news quite a bit. And we felt that with Roy de Rovers, the worst thing you could do is make him a bad boy and cover him in tattoos and, you know, get him out there getting into all sorts of trouble just because, well, that's a bit edgy and that's kind of like what some footballers are now. Actually, the braver thing to do was to say, no, we want to stay true to the character and keep him, you know, keep him that kind of upstanding kid, you know, keep him as that guy that is aspirational for kids rather than somebody who's, you know, an anti-hero. He was never an anti-hero. That's not what the character's about. So that's what we set out to do, and we've stuck to it. And actually, I think it's credit to Rob Williams and Tom Palmer that they've made him feel so real. You know, I think that's one of the problems that Roy de Rovers had at some points in the history of his run, not always, but every now and then, was he did feel a bit whiter than white and a little bit unbelievable and a little bit lacking in grit. And actually what Rob and Tom have done is give him plenty of grit. He's got a very, he's got a tough upbringing. You know, he's had it hard. He's comes from a working class background. He's had nothing laid out on a plate for him, and everything he gets, he has to work very hard for. And he's constantly running up against problems and having things not go his way. And does he score a lot of goals? Yeah. Yeah, he does, because he's Royal Rovers. But it's not easy to get there. And the payoff, that only works as a payoff if he's gone through the sort of stuff that Rob and Tom put him through. So, you know, they've done a brilliant job in keeping him grounded in that way, which isn't an easy job at all, I don't think. But yeah, so, you know, we've been very keen to stick with that with Royal Rovers. And with Rocky as well, I think, you know, she is a different... She has a different set of characteristics, and she's a new character, whole cloth. She's never existed in the former sort of continuity of the character. So gave us an opportunity to do something different. And she is very different to Roy. She's much, you know, she's sharper tongued. She's perhaps a bit more aggressive. She's a lot of fun, and she's constantly needling at Roy. And I think she's a great role model, actually, for girls who want to get into football and might need a little bit more about them if they want to push through and you know, get out there and kick lumps out of boys and show that they're better than them. She's that girl, you know. So it's been a lot of fun, but we've been very careful to make sure that the characters are inclusive and are aspirational, you know. And that's been a key word for us all the way along. You know, Roy Rovers is supposed to be a... Well, to our mind, he's supposed to be something of a role model, you know. He's supposed to be something to aspire to, that kids think, okay, I can go out and play the game the way it's supposed to be played and be successful. And Rocky's the same, you know, for girls who want to get out there and play. She represents the same thing. And, you know, it's great timing that women's football is getting such a great push, and that it's becoming more and more visible, and that lots of the people we work with, Match of the Day, Mundial magazine, etc., they're all doing their best to put women's football to the fore and saying, look, this is just a legitimate, all football is good football. And we've always thought that from the start. That's why Rocky's always been playing. That's why in the series so far, we've actually had Roy coaching Rocky's team. We've had the girls, you know, we've watched the girls play, we've watched Rocky play, you know. It's been an integral part of it. So, you know, we're very proud that we've been doing that from the beginning. And this latest announcement is a good opportunity to just throw a bit of light on that and get even more kids involved who maybe haven't seen it so far or didn't necessarily think it was for them because there was a boy on the cover.
Ultimately, it's the thing about the National Literacy Trust that I'm most interested in, because this is a less than usual way of doing comics. And, you know, it's not just comics, it's also, you know, prose novels as well. How important was that for it not just to be, oh, let's just bung him out in another comic, let's just have Rocky in another comic and see how it does? It's linked into literacy and as you say, aspiration and things like that.
Yeah, the literacy angle has always been an important one for us. I think we knew that, like, if we were going to launch a football comic, well, you're competing with football, aren't you? You're competing with going out and running around and kicking a ball. You're competing with watching the Premier League. You're competing with, you know, seeing what... well, you're competing with playing FIFA on the Xbox or the PlayStation or whatever. So there's a lot of competition out there for kids who are hungry for football content. I hate the word content, but I've just said it, so I'll stick with it.
Not the first, won't be the last.
No, wait. But, you know, so we knew that if we were to engage with those kids, then working with somebody like the National Literacy Trust was important, because they are all about bringing in kids who either don't read or have no real interest in reading, and showing them what's so great about picking up a book or picking up a comic. Now, I'm sure everybody here in doing this podcast has all got their own stories about how comics helps them on the road to becoming a reader. And, you know, we're all to some extent or another professional readers now. And, you know, that's been very important to me from the beginning. Comics were the first thing I read. They were the first thing that helped me read. And working with the National Literacy Trust allows us to put that message right at the front. You know, reading is not just worthy and not just the sort of thing that your teachers are going to push on you, and not just the sort of thing that your mum and dad say you ought to be doing. It's something that is fun and something that is for you, as more than for anyone else. Reading is for you. And having something like this, having a character like Roy the Rovers, it gives us that opportunity to present two kids who maybe are more interested in running around kicking balls, actually, this is for you, and this is a world that you can lose yourself in, and hopefully it'll introduce a broader world of reading to them at a nice early age. You know, these books are for 8 to 12 year olds, and dads and granddads and mums and grandmas, but ostensibly for 8 to 12 year old boys and girls, you know. So it's important to you know, lay that, you know, sow that seed early doors and get them out there and get them reading. And the National Literacy Trust, their messaging is absolutely bang on for what we want to do. They're very proactive in getting out to kids who not just kids who don't have interest in reading, but kids who don't have access to reading. And I think that's been a big part of it as well. Roy is a poor working class kid in our books, and one of the first things that we did working with the National Literacy Trust was give away 10,000 books to kids in areas that were identified as being in as not having access to books and to literacy resources. So we've given them away through schools and through libraries and through community centres and things like that. You know, it's all part of engaging with kids and giving them something that is theirs. Reading is for you. And you know, and that kind of shaped the way we developed the project from the start, because we knew that if we were to compete with the Premiership and FIFA and everything else, then our stuff had to feel cool and current, and you know, it had to feel real to a certain extent. That's why Roy's wearing a Hummel kit with a Real World sponsor on it and has a boot deal, and you know, he looks like a real footballer. It looks like a real football kit. It looks like a team that could exist in the world, and it looks like a team that you can root for, no matter where you're from in the country, no matter what your background is. You can follow Melchester Rovers, you can follow Roy's story, and own it. You know, it's yours. And as the story goes on, it'll get more complex and no doubt grow with the readers, and we've got some pretty astonishing stuff lined up for the second season, which I won't go into here, but it's really exciting to be able to sort of plant the seed that reading is a really exciting and engaging thing for kids, you know, as young as 8 or 9.
And what I know about football can be written in the corner of a very small postage stamp.
No.
And yeah, it's crazy. I imagine there's one or two people started listening to this podcast and were like, I don't care about comics. Sorry, I don't care about football. Some people might say that. You know, this is kind of, and I'm sorry that I'm going to say this, but this is kind of comics plus, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is placing comics back in the place in the development of reading, of entertainment, where it should be, where it always was.
Yeah, as part of mainstream culture. That's the thing. That's always been the aim with, not just with Roy the Rovers, but with other, you know, with other things that we're going to be developing out of you know, properties that we now own across the Treasury and across other plans that we have over the next few years. You know, it's down to us to get these characters out there into the mainstream and get comics out there to the level that they once were. I mean, you know, obviously at the moment nothing is selling 500,000 copies a week. Nothing is selling that, but aspirationally it's good for us to think, okay, maybe if we can build these audiences, maybe if we can break comics out to kids who like football, to kids who like, I don't know, other stuff that I can't think of examples for right now. But you know, if we can take comics away from being push comics back out to where they were, which is, there was a point where comics were for everybody. If you had an interest, you could find a comic that was for you. And if you look in our archive, that it's so evident, like the range of comics that's been that we now own, that have been published over the years, it's breathtaking.
Well, that was the point that the manga translator Zach Davison made at San Diego last year. He said, you know, the thing about manga is that whatever you're into, you can find it in manga, and to an extent that was true of British comics. Oliver, what's your perspective on that? You look like you wanted to say something.
You were ready, your boys. But it's true, isn't it? There's so much stuff over there. We've been over and had a look in the archive before, and there's just...
Yeah, even the stuff that we've published is only a fraction of the types of genre that there are over there. It's a medium. It's not a genre. Yeah. You know.
And we haven't even begun to scratch the
photo
surface.
Photo comics.
It's crazy.
Well,
yeah.
Let's bring those back in 2020.
Yes. Stick that on the schedule. Why not?
But it's always interesting with people, and obviously we'll come on to talk a bit more about the Treasury stuff in a second, but when people say, oh, why haven't you republished this yet? And it's it's only so many books we can bring out a month without flooding the market.
All of us, we've all at some point been over and had a look at the archive and opened up a book, opened up a box, and we've all got the same story, which is you can go over there, open a box at random, and go, oh, well, everything in this box is brilliant and needs to be republished. Yeah. I've never heard of any of it. You know, we've all got that story. And there's so much of it. You know, we now own, like, a century's worth of comics publishing. You know, we can't get everything back out there again, but we are trying to pick and choose our battles and pick the stuff that... Well, you know, there's always multiple considerations. It's stuff that fans want. It's stuff that we want. It's stuff that we feel is commercially viable. It's stuff that we feel that still stands up. There's, you know, there's a real mix of things that you need, of considerations you need to make before we're publishing these things. But it's bloody exciting to go over there and have a look. And I mean, to go back to tie back to the reading point you made earlier about comics being something that can help people get into reading, I think we've probably all got a different route in to our career that was a different type of comic. Because even when we were younger, we're not that old, we're getting old, we're not that old, but even when we were younger, there was a broader range. You know, I think the first, you know, I was delighted when we picked up Battle and Action. That was all stuff that that really helped me learn how to read.
Yeah.
Especially Battle, inheriting Battle annuals and big stacks of that comic. That was the thing that that really turned me on to comics, but also just to reading full stop. I really struggled to read when I was a kid, and I'm sure we've all got stories like that. And it was because I was a warlike child who wanted to play with guns and things and run around and hit people with sticks, that actually when I found, oh, there's this whole thing, and nobody's stopping me reading it, and there's a lot of people hitting people with sticks in here and shooting people and stuff, and you know, it's you discover this thing that you can take ownership of, and then you run with it. And we've got so much, we've got so many characters and properties in the archive that we can bring back that will still have relevance now, that will still be able to do that job for us now. That's before we get to stuff that we want to do that's brand new, stuff that we feel that we can put a modern spin on, stuff that we can reboot entirely. You know, it's really exciting. There's a lot we can do.
Let's talk just a little bit more about Rocky. As a character, because obviously the landscape in comics is changing quite rapidly. You're seeing a lot more women who are not just women characters, but also women working within the industry. How important do you think it is to have a character like Rocky rather than just Roy?
Well, it comes down to representation again, doesn't it? You know, and when you're looking at women's football, it is starting to break out into the mainstream and start to become something that a broader audience are interested in. But if kids don't know it's there and know there are these characters for them and know there are these things that they can aspire to, then they're not gonna try, you know, and they're not gonna go looking for them. I think Rocky in particular is, as I was saying earlier, she's a great character. She's a lot of fun. And she's nothing like Roy, and she is for the girls. You know, she's theirs, and she's not what you might expect from, you know, it's not what a girl's footballer would have been portrayed as in 1974. You know, she's tough. She gets her, you know, she gets her nose bloodied, she gets her knees scraped, and she gets stuck in. So Rocky is, she's better at football than Roy. I'm just going to go out there and say it. She just is better than Roy. But she goes out there, she gets her nose bloodied, she gets her knees scraped, and she gets stuck in. And she is a character that girls who want to get into football can look at and go, okay, I can do that. I can be like that. I want to be that like that. I want to be out there with my elbows getting stuck in, and getting stuck in at a point where women's football is starting to break through, you know, where it's starting to become more of a mainstream concern. And for us, it wasn't about jumping on a bandwagon or sort of, you know, just saying, oh, well, the BBC is showing a lot more women's football, maybe we should do that. It's like we've built in from the beginning that sport is for everybody, football is for everybody, and Royal Rovers is for everybody. That's the whole thing, you know. And, you know, we've also so Lisa Henker is doing the artwork for Rocky. She's drawn the strip that's coming up in the Tammy and Ginny special, and she's fantastic. And she Keith Richardson, our Royal Rovers editor, graphic novels editor, but he's been editing Royal Rovers. He found Lisa really early on in the project, and she's fantastic. She's just, she has such an eye for football, actually, and for sport, and for the way bodies move, and the way football is, the way football can be shown in comics. She's like this maverick footballing genius that we've discovered out of nowhere, and she's been doing all the illustrations for the kids fiction, and we'll be working with her more. She's, as I said, she's done the Rocky strip in the Tammy and Ginny special, and you know, again, it's you know, you don't have to be a boy to draw football. Mm. You know, she's better at this than almost anyone I've ever seen, and she's not a boy. You know, so again, you know, it's all about being inclusive. It's all about football being for everyone, and yeah, just flying that flag.
Mm. Now, like I said, I know nothing about football, but you do.
Well, arguable. I'm a West Ham fan, so not that much.
I don't know what that means. It's just a collection of words. What does it mean to you to be involved in this project from the off?
Well, I never thought I'd get to work on anything like this in my life.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, so me and my brother, I'll say it straight out there, my brother is the big football fan in my family. And I was the annoying little brother who followed him around and wanted to kick a ball with him, but actually wasn't very good and just used to punt the ball over the fence, you know. So I've always sort of trailed my brother around, but I've, you know, as a result, I was bullied into supporting West Ham. Not bullied, I embraced it wholeheartedly. But, you know, we've supported West Ham our whole life. My dad's a West Ham fan. My family are all football fans. And, you know, so football is very much part of the family life for me. And you know, I've been going to football since I was pretty young, going to Upton Park and then latterly to the Olympic Stadium. And you know, it's a big deal in my house, and it's, you know, it's a big deal in the country. It's maybe not a big deal in our office, but almost everywhere else football is a very big deal. And you know, it's never been lost on me. You know, I played for school teams when I was a kid, and me and my brother both played for North. You know, local teams. We played most of our lives. I played five-a-side until not that recently. I'm just old now and knackered. But, you know, football has been very much a big part of my life. Mm. And for any football fan anywhere, you know who Roy the Rovers is. You know what it is. I read it when I was a kid. You know, there were annuals kicking around. There were comics kicking around. We did it. You know, it was something I engaged with early on. And it's not lost on me how big a character this is. When we first realised we owned him, I was shell shocked that we actually owned Roy the Rovers and that we could do something with it. Because, you know, like I said, any football fan knows the potential of just that name. You know, it's mentioned week in, week out. It was mentioned over the World Cup. It's, you know, the Roy the Rovers story, the real Roy the Rovers stuff. It is right there, right in the DNA of British football. You know, so it was a huge thing to get involved in. And there were things that I just never thought I'd get to do that I did rope my brother into, because I knew he'd be excited about it as well. But stuff like, you know, when we were kids, we used to design kits for West Ham in the back of our school books, right? When we were kids, we used to design badges for imaginary clubs, right? And come up with team sheets for imaginary clubs. And we used to, you know, and, you know, all of this stuff, and obsessively play football, Championship Manager as it was, and Football Manager, and any football game we get our hands on, and put our own players in and create our own clubs and do all that. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, I got to work on an actual kit with Hummel, and I got kit designs plopping into my inbox, and got to open them up and go, oh my god, these are actual kit designs from an actual sports manufacturer. Yeah. We got to design a new badge for Melchester Rovers. And it was so much fun. It was so much fun. And it just wasn't lost to me at all. And I was talking to my brother about this. I asked my brother, I know I keep on talking about my brother, but he's been as excited about this as I was. He's a kit obsessive, right? So he's got every West Ham kit going back donkey's years. And so I got to go and sort of say to him, you know, after all these years of him being football mad and me following him around, I got to go to him and go, what do you think of this then? What do you think of this? And see him go, oh, blimey, look at that. Oh, what about that? You could do something with that collar though. And then going, yeah, we probably could do something with that collar, and going and doing it. It's brilliant. So, you know, it's been so much fun, and it's just going to continue being like that. You know, it's as with so many aspects of this job that, you know, I'm sure you get every day, I'm sure Oliver gets every day, that you can't believe you get to do some of this stuff. You know, so it's, yeah, not lost on me at all.
Yeah. Wonderful. You have a cold. I dread to think what you'd be like on the podcast without a cold. sort of speaking twice as fast. But anyway, thank you, Rob. Oliver, I want to move on to you because one of the other exciting announcements that has been made this week is about the...
Trigon Empire.
Trigon Empire.
Yeah.
We're both in the north. We can say what we want. Which is Mike Butterworth and Don Lawrence's... not lost... I know we said lost in the original article that we did.
It ended in the 80s, yeah. So it might be in some people's minds, and there was a few reprints sort of in the mid-80s, but I think maybe there was one in 1990.
Right.
But yeah, so I guess it's been nearly 30 years since it's been in print.
Mm. What is the Trigon Empire, first off?
Well, the Trigon Empire is a long-running sci-fi series that started in 1965 in Ranger magazine, and then within a year, Ranger was absorbed by Look and Learn, and then it ran through there, which Look and Learn was a notoriously educational comic. And in the centre of it, there was this two-page, fully painted, slightly bonkers sci-fi comic that was kind of sort of took elements of the Roman Empire and the Greek era and sort of melded them into a big sci-fi story. Mm. So the Trigon Empire is a bit of fun. In this otherwise dry comic, and so I think that's probably why it's remembered quite fondly.
Mm.
Look and Learn was the comic that schools allowed to have, allowed students to read, because it had cutaways, educational cutaways, yeah, of you know, battleships and buildings and, you know, historical comic stories about everyone, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I think this was their way of... I presume it's the editor's way of getting it in there and getting away with something.
Rewarding the kids. Well, rewarding the kids. You've made your way through the educational stuff.
Here's a tasty morsel for learning.
It's straight off the bat, it's an interesting kind of link between what we've been talking about, Roy the Rovers, and something like Look and Learn. Like, kids have got to enjoy learning. It can't be dry and dusty.
Yeah, and there are certainly... when I say it's based on like the Roman Empire, it really is. There's the guy called... I'm really sorry, this is going to be a bit dry, so feel free to edit this to hell. You've got this guy called Trigo. He led a tribe and started he banded this tribe together to form a new empire to hold off the Locans, and they formed a treaty with the Hurricanes. And so, it's got all these parallels with Roman Empire and how they were when they were starting out and that kind of stuff. I repeated myself.
No. It's great. But, I mean, let's face it, the big selling point...
The big selling point is Don Lawrence's
artwork. Yeah, the mighty Don Lawrence.
He was painting this. This isn't like standard black and white comic stuff. This is full colour painted stuff, and he was doing 2 pages a week. He did nearly 1,000 pages over the course of a decade, which is crazy for painting comic pages.
Yeah.
And because of the nature of the story being 2 pages a week, these weren't sort of big splash pages. These were 8, 10, 12 panel pages, and each panel can be blown up and done as a single image kind of style. It's really nice stuff. Just on a really slightly dry note, we have got scans of the artwork. Like, when we're printing these books are going to be taken from the original artwork.
I don't know much about Don Lawrence, to be honest. Like, how did he arrive? How does anybody arrive at that style? That seems supremely uneconomical. 2 pages of painting a week. I mean, obviously, it's beautiful looking stuff, and I've seen it, and it is just a joy to behold. But I don't know much about him. Like, what had he done before?
He'd done a lot of Western comics.
Yeah,
He'd done other sort of historical things.
Okay.
But mostly, it was black and white kind of Viking era adventure stories.
Right.
But I don't know why all of a sudden he switched from black and white to fully painted colour. I don't know if there was like a strip in between his black and white and Trigon Empire era where he was like, I'm going to test out this this thing.
This colour, you say? Yeah.
Or maybe it was a case of, obviously the eagle had Dandare, and that was in colour because it was on the cover. And I think that was always seen as like the benchmark of like a really great strip. And so when he had this opportunity for the Trigon Empire, he just thought, I'm going for it. I'm going to do colour. It's going to be painted, which is better than Dandare.
Well, I mean, that's ultimately the comparison is to Frank Hampson, who did Dandare. You know, you've got Frank Hampson and Don Lawrence, who are just these absolute titans of...
I'd probably throw in Frank Bellamy.
Oh, Frank Bellamy, of course, yeah, sorry.
Frank Bellamy followed Frank Hampson. I think he was probably closer to Don Lawrence in terms of style.
Yeah.
And Frank Bellamy definitely was a painter. And whereas Frank Hampson had his studio, Frank Bellamy was more of a single artist kind of doing his own thing.
Right. I'm going to show my ignorance again. Was Don Lawrence writing it as well?
No.
Mike Butterworth.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's interesting that this period, and we've talked about this before when we did the tribute to Ron Smith a few months ago, how what is expected of an artist in terms of work rate and standard now is different to how it was 40-50 years ago. So, you know, if you were a journeyman illustrator, you could bang out two fully painted pages a week of comic strip.
Yeah.
You know, that nowadays you wouldn't necessarily commission that, and B, you wouldn't necessarily find somebody who'd be able to keep to that schedule. But because that was what comics were.
Yeah.
I'm very wary about describing him as journeyman.
Well, no, I never mean journeyman in a negative sense. I just mean somebody who has been on
a long journey.
Yeah, he was a professional. I was going through it, and he took off 2 months in 1969, and another 2 months in 1972. And then a year before he quit, he took a year off and then came back and finished off like a year's worth of comics. And just like, I'm done now. But so over the decade, he had like two holidays.
Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. I mean, from a 2080 point of view, because Don Lawrence's greatest legacy is his influence on, two of our most popular artists, Chris Weston and Liam Sharp. Liam, of course, who's just been doing a lauded run on Green Lantern, and Chris, who's, you know, needs no real introduction for anybody who loves 2080, because they both were interns with him for a while, weren't they? And particularly in Chris's work, you can really see the influence there.
With Chris's figure work, you can definitely see the influence. Mm. I know Liam was with Don more towards the end of Don's life, and indeed sort of helped him along a little bit on the last few Storm books that he did. Mm. Chris and Liam are both been in touch, and they're really enthusiastic about these books.
And we've got plans for events around the launch, just because, I mean, it's not just, obviously Don and Mike aren't with us, but it won't just be a case of setting up a signing. I mean, this is a kind of one of those, without sounding too dry, cultural artifacts.
Yeah, I've seen some of the pages of the artwork, the original pages, and they are incredible. And yeah, we would love to have a big exhibition.
Yeah. With something like the Trigon Empire, we're getting to some of the meat of the archive now, aren't we? We've been publishing stuff for a couple of years.
Just been pretending.
No. We've not been pretending it, but you know, there's been some great stuff. It's just been difficult to pick out which jewels we're going to go with first.
Also, with the Trigon Empire, it's 1,000 pages long.
Yeah,
it's taken a while to just sort it out and to actually get it into a place where we decided how to break it up into four books for the main Don Lawrence stuff, and just getting it prepared and ready and so that when people read it, they can really enjoy it, and they're not, you know, waiting.
So obviously there was we're doing the Don Lawrence stuff, but it wasn't just Don Lawrence.
No, other artists. There was Ron Embleton, Miguel Quesada. There are a few other artists towards the end of Don Lawrence's tenure, and then after Don Lawrence, there was more artists taking over from 1976 to 80. 3. But to start with, we want to publish the Don Lawrence stuff in its entirety.
In
4 volumes, and just get all the stuff, the absolute gold out there. Well, the first volume is entirely Don Lawrence, and then we'll see how this goes. But we'd love to include the Miguel Quesada and Ron Embleton stories, because they're fantastic. Ron Embleton was a great artist as well. He did lots on the Thunderbirds for TV21 and so on.
And this is really going to be the first proper time that this is all in a mass market book, is it? Because I know Hamlin did like a kind of run.
They picked some stories here and there. Yeah. We're publishing right from the start, all the way through, all of Don Lawrence's stories in chronological order. You can see him grow. The first story isn't bad, but even by the third story, he is on top of his game.
Yeah,
he's absolutely astounding. But it's going to be all the stories that he drew in chronological order.
And it's kind of just tying back into what you were saying earlier about getting comics out there and getting them out in these formats again that people can afford and people can collect, and we can really push out wider for everybody to get hold of. This isn't my project, but I've watched it being developed, and you know, these are stories that haven't been available in an accessible, affordable format for a long time, and that's the whole point of the Treasury, is to take these absolute jewels that people have not seen for a long time and make them affordable again and make them out there available in the mass market. You know, it's a really important big job that the Treasury has got to do. So, you know, no wonder it takes us time to, you know, get through all this stuff.
Without sounding like some kind of salesman, I would say...
Sound like a salesman. Okay. Let's sell it.
Okay. These books are going to be the same size as the Charlie's War books. Yeah. They're going to be longer than the Charlie's War books. They're going to be 304 pages for the first book. Mm. It's colour, entirety, all the way through, full colour artwork. Same price as Charlie's War.
Blimey.
What a steal. Buy one for you, one for your mate, and one for your mum.
One for your mum. I'm literally about to say that. In terms of the story, because looking through the archive, you know, there's lots of stuff we can't wait to republish. There's also stuff that we're probably never going to republish again. And it can be easy to look back on this stuff with rose-tinted glasses. Mm. But with a lot of this stuff, I mean, you're coming to it fresh. The stuff you're working on, you've never read before.
This isn't stuff that I read as a kid, but it is stuff I heard about and was interested in, and it is stuff that I sought out a few years ago. So it's definitely things I have interest in.
Looking
at these as a contemporary reader, I think what does help it a lot is that it is set in a faux historical setting that's also a science fiction setting, in that it's not... You know, it was written and drawn in the 60s and 70s, but it's because it's not set in the 60s and 70s, it doesn't have that kind of tinge of, old-fashionedness, if you like. It's because it's so old-fashioned.
Yeah.
It sticks very well.
You got any more notes there, buddy?
I do, but they're all really dry, let's be honest.
No, seriously. Mate, think about the audience for this podcast. They like dry.
Did you know that Mike Butterworth not only wrote crime novels under his real name, which was John Michael Butterworth, but he also wrote gothic romances under the name of Carola Salisbury?
Wow. That is a superb name.
Carola Salisbury, gothic romance.
That's fantastic.
I wish I had a title so you could hunt that down. but they're out there. Yeah, easy to find, I'm sure. There can't be many authors with the name Carola Salisbury.
I love stuff like that. Because you got that with Chris Lowther, who's Jack Adrian one minute and then he was something else the next. And, you know, John Wagner and Alan Grant had multiple aliases that they used. And for some, clearly, it was because they were working in different genres. And, you know, Mike Butterworth, gothic romance, probably doesn't work as well. But others, it was so that them, because their editors were worried that it looked like they'd written the entire thing, which they had.
Yeah.
I love stuff like that.
I was just going to say, just briefly about the release schedule for Trigon. With the first book being 304 pages, we are going to get a second book out in 2020 towards the end of the year, which is going to be about 284 pages. So it you know, that's half the Don Lawrence stuff in the first year.
Yeah.
And then 2021, and I guess towards the very start of 2022, that'll finish it off. So it will be released all within a relatively short span. So you won't be waiting too long. Not as quick as Charlie's War re-release that we did, which was one a month and nearly broke everyone.
But it's worth just talking a little bit about the repro on this stuff. Obviously, we haven't got somebody in from our repro team who are in another office at the moment before we move into our new premises. But the sheer amount of reproduction work that has to be done on these books is fantastic. We're lucky with the Trigon Empire that we've got so much of it already.
Yeah, with the Trigon Empire, yeah, we were very lucky. The artwork had been scanned before it was sold/thefted.
Oh my god.
Thieved by people in the office. But collectors have been collecting this artwork, and there was in about 2003-2004 there was a publisher in Holland who worked incredibly hard to ensure that he had scans of everything. And so we were working with him on getting these files to get these books printed in the best possible way. But yeah, usually our reprographics team who do the work on most of our books are fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, they're great. Yeah, Joe, Emma and Rich over there in the other building, they are absolutely brilliant at what they do. I don't know if either of you guys have ever tried to clean up anything.
It's a nightmare.
Yep. It's a nightmare, and they have just turned into the most efficient, brilliant unit. You know, they can just roll through anything. It doesn't matter how dirty the pages are, how smudged, how much bleed through there's been. It doesn't matter. They just get through the whole lot. It's astonishing.
Some of those books that we have literally have water damage.
Yeah. Some of them are disgusting. They're just bits, you know, and it's just amazing what they do. Like, and you know, when you look at how old some of the material is as well. I mean, just Brant Royder Rovers again, but you know, Rich has been working on the early Royder Rovers material for a 50s collection. It's out soon. The first pages of that, and these came from a collector who looked after them very, very, very well. Even then, they're still, you know, they're still a mess.
These were printed on poor quality paper. You know, they were never meant to last this long.
No, exactly. You know, and they're well loved.
Yeah.
You know, they've been read. You know, the staples have rusted. There's holes. There's all sorts of stuff, and they just do an amazing job over there pulling it all together. It would drive me insane trying to do 5 pages, and they just rattle through hundreds of them. You know, it's incredible.
Yeah, so I mean, in the future, we're going to have a podcast special on the work they do when they have 5 minutes to actually spare and sit down.
Get Joe and Emma and Rich in here, and
talk about contrast and levels and things like that. And you thought your notes were dry? That's going to be a great episode.
Yeah.
It's bloody interesting, though.
Yeah,
it is interesting.
Absolutely.
You know, you should do some sort of live, you know, you should do some sort of video coming where they show them actually cleaning up a page, because it is fascinating to watch. It really is.
The best thing is when the books come in for the first time from the printers and we all smell the books.
Yeah. We all get high what we do.
That's what we do, We love books and printing them.
Yeah, no.
We're book people.
Absolutely.
That's for sure.
Absolutely. Well, guys, thanks so much for coming in.
Mate.
It's been fascinating. It's going to be interesting to see what the reaction to Rocky is like. And if the reaction to the news about Trigon Empire is anything to go by, then lots of people looking forward to 2020.
I think they're going to really enjoy it. I hope it's everything they dreamed for. What they've got in their heads is met with the actual reality of the book.
Absolutely. And we're obviously going to be making announcements over the coming year about what we're going to be doing that's special to mark the release of Trigon Empire. But in the meantime, thanks very much to Rob.
Cheers. Thank
thanks
you.
Thanks very much to Oliver.
Thank you.
And thank you very much to you, our loyal listeners. Be sure to rate us on the podcast app of your choice. And if you've got any comments, thrillcast@2000ad.com. That's thrillcast, all one word, @2000ad.com. I've been your host, Maltjar. And until next time, Earthlets, Splendid Verthrig.
Alert!
cell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagents now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline. And follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.